and welcome to Vorpal Tales, the podcast. We are your hosts, Tyler, Sean.
Hello.
And today, guest stars Rachel.
Hey.
And Eric.
Hello.
Sean, tell everyone why they're here.
We are here for a podcast.
Specifically.
Oh, specifically, got you. We are here to talk about from the home office in Helena, Montana. The research has asked us to talk about unknown armies.
Mm-hmm. So, Eric, give us a rundown, like a synopsis, like a TLDR.
Well, I like the analogy that I used when I was coming up with the consent forms for this game. Unknown Armies is like if Quentin Tarantino and David Lynch teamed up to make a movie scored by Tom Waits, and that was equal parts action and transcendental horror.
Did you come up with that description?
I guess I did.
That's a hell of a description.
Oh, thank you.
That invokes a lot of different imageries and concepts that... Yeah, you're going to have to... Eric, elaborate.
Well, because you had me at Quentin Tarantino.
Well, to hear them, the makers of Unknown Armies, describe their own game, it's a role-playing game of transcendental horror and furious action. That's what it says on the first edition core rulebook. And on the cover, there is an image of what I... believed to be one of the co-creators dead, shot through the chest on a table, and their blood is leaking out onto the floor. There's all sorts of weird occult looking knickknacks around the room, but their blood spells out, "You did it."
Huh. Did what?
Yeah, that. You did it. It's a constant visual motif that shows up through the core book and all the supplement books. It's usually written in blood on a wall or spelled out in pills or whatever, but it's always the same thing. You did it. That line always kind of stuck with me and inspired me in weird ways to that the other settings for other games have not. I don't know why, but it worked. I remember instantly sort of getting this particular game and other ones for... and probably perhaps because of this, because some of the same people that worked on Unknown Armies, surprise surprise, worked on Delta Green as well.
That tracks.
John Scott Tynes, Greg Stolze, a lot of these people, Dennis Dittweiler, if you're familiar with these names, they all contributed to the creation of this universe, and it's very weird and pretty mind-blowing at times, and it intrigued me right off the bat.
That's really cool. I'm a big fan of Greg Stolze. He wrote some vampire novels that I think really get to the core of what it means to be a vampire.
Really? He's excellent. He actually, one of the little fictional short stories he wrote for one of the supplement books is one of my favorite things I think I've ever read of his. And it's about an old man who is in the setting of Unknown Armies called the First and Last Man. Colloquially, he's kind of known in the occult underground as the Comte of Saint Germain. You know, he's this immortal guy.
Oh,
that asshole, precisely. Yeah. So if you're familiar with that name or that moniker, yeah, that's who he is essentially. Mm-hmm. And he is not easily fit into a category of good or bad. He's an immortal, so he's been all of those things and more. And boy, he kind of hates it sometimes. And so it's an interesting setting, and he's just a very small part of it.
So I think what we'll do for this episode is the three of us will take turns asking Eric fun questions about the setting. I'll fire it off with the one I want to know. Tell me about this whole 333-something people rule the world secretly.
Ah.
What's that about?
Ah, yes. Okay, so this is where it gets transcendental, right? In this game, there are people who fall into the social consciousness as archetypes. Think Unbreakable and how Bruce Willis's character was kind of the archetype of the Guardian or whatever, right? He had special powers. When he bumped into people, he can kind of get flashes of what they're about to do, and he could stop them. He had the power to stop them. These people are called avatars. when they become powerful enough, they ascend and become part of a godhead that's called the Invisible Clergy. When all 333 archetypes ascend to the clergy, the world ends. And then everything starts all over again. But the next time around, the world and everything around us will be forged by those 333 people who ascended. Some are good, some not so much. So for the people who are clued into this cosmology in the occult underground, sometimes they'll try to supplant the previous avatar of, say, the Masterless Man, or the Dark Stalker, or the Mother. There's a place in the universe called the House of Renunciation. It's an enormous house that never ends. It's arguably a living thing that sends out agents and that it grants metaphysical powers to, and it allows them to abduct people and bring them back to it for the purpose of locking them up in one of the various rooms of this never-ending twist and turn house. There, they're sort of magically held for a period of time necessary for that person to undergo a natural 180 degree of their previous views and personality. Like they go into the house one way, and when they exit, they're the exact opposite of who they were.
Hmm.
That's fascinating.
Magic, of course, is real in this universe. Magicians are essentially called adepts. They perform paradoxical actions in order for the universe to grant them power over anything from history to random chance. So an entropomancer or chaos mage, for instance, could play a round of Russian roulette. If they don't die, well, now they have enough mojo to win the Powerball.
That's a good way to do magic.
Mages have to follow these paradoxical rules, however, else they lose all their charges. Epidromancers, for instance, can't let anyone give them a haircut or work on their teeth, for example. Flesh warpers, or cutters as they're called, they hurt themselves for power. The more permanent, the more powerful they get. So you lose a finger, well, you can make yourselves look like anyone, or, you know, melt somebody's face off on the paper towel aisle at the local Walmart, whatever you want to do.
That's very Clive Barker. I love it.
Yes, actually, that's one of the inspirations for the setting, I want to say. Specifically for me, I at least I don't know about anybody else, but you remember the movie Lord of Illusions?
Hell yeah.
My favorite
all-time movies.
That fits very nicely into the Unknown Army's universe, so to speak.
What question you got, Rachel? Uh-oh, we can't hear Rachel.
Oh, nope. Rachel. I thought you guys cut off.
Oh, nope, sorry. And what question you got for him?
Oh, I have a bunch. From the perspective of a game runner, what sort of stories would you run for your table at Unknown Armies?
I can give you an example of some that I've run in the past. Unknown Armies was actually my first role-playing game that I ever ran at a table. I didn't start with D&D. I mean, I played D&D and stuff like that, but I never gravitated toward them for whatever reason. I always went to these oddball games, and Unknown Armies was just the right kind of oddball game for me for some reason at that time. Came out like in the late 90s. So I was like just exiting high school, and I picked it up and I ran. The first campaign that I ever ran was about a group of Vietnam veterans this is taking place like in the 90s or whatever. They come back to, they go to attend a funeral of one of their buddies who got murdered. But it doesn't look like they got murdered. So they're actually investigating that, and they come across like they ended up fighting Muppets that came to life and had actually asphyxiated their buddy. And they got into all sorts of crazy situations where like Muppets were hanging off of their car and they were shooting them off, and they got arrested by the police. And then, you know, Muppets that was being controlled by these people who were vengeful against their long dead buddy, who was involved in, you know, those operations back in Vietnam that dumped napalm onto villages and such. Well, there were some thanatomancers or death mages that were really kind of pissed off about that. So they decided to take their vengeance and it involved stuff like that. And yeah, it was really weird, but my players really enjoyed it. And I was surprised I did as well as I did with my first game. So ever since then, I was just kind of riffing off of that, coming up with other little games that involve some of the different factions. Because it's a game that was initially created in the 90s and progressed into the 2000s with the second edition, it's very traditional in that you have a meta plot. With the newest edition, though, they kind of did away with all of that and instead invited the players at the table to make up their own. So every time you sit down and play on an army, it's a completely different thing, which is kind of a neat idea. And it's kind of ballsy, really, to kind of subvert your own thing. These are the same people who made it, you know, 20 plus years ago here. And here they are again, making it and essentially subverting a lot of stuff that they established from the onset, which is kind of neat.
That's cool.
What you guys?
So I'm sort of getting, if you like running like really bonkers off the wall stories, this is the game you want.
Kind of, yeah. There's a lot of symbology and weird conspiracies and secret societies and death cults and all sorts of stuff like that. And yeah, I gained a lot of inspiration from things from that time, like the X-Files, Millennium. Jacob's Ladder was a big influence on me for horror. Was one of my favorite old horror movies. It actually helped inspire that first campaign that I mentioned, as a matter of fact. And yeah, just the old Silent Hill games, I think, also like get the tone across a little bit. Because it's all ultimately, Unknown Armies is not about monsters, right? Like, not the typical sort of monsters that you expect when you crack open a Call of Cthulhu game or whatever. Like, oh, this is a tentacled monstrosity, whatever. Unknown Armies is about obsession, power, and how people are the real monsters in horror games. It forces your character, the rules, that is, they force your character to change over the course of the story with the rise and fall of their stress gauges. And those are composed of like five different stressors: violence, the unnatural, isolation, helplessness, and self.
Yeah, that actually feeds into my next question, if I can go a little bit out of turn.
Sure.
Yeah. So what is unique about this setting, and what is unique about the mechanics, and how do they interact?
Mechanics are actually not that unique, at least not in terms of like how they're approached, because it uses a percentile system just like Call of Cthulhu. But so you have skills, right? You have abilities, and they have a percentage to them. So you just want to roll underneath that. Very straightforward. The only sort of narrative twists that they threw into it are if you get a matched success or matched failure, it's good. It's an extra good or an extra bad. If you roll 100, of course, it's a tremendous failure. And if you roll a 1, it's like, oh, wow, you did everything you wanted and more. There are some nice additions, though, in the way, because if you're playing these broken sort of characters a lot of the time, obsessed characters, you have an obsession, or you can choose not to have one, but everybody, especially mages, need to have their magic or their thing linked to their obsession. Anytime you go to use your skill or you do something in favor of your obsession, you get to flip-flop that role. So it's not just if you rolled a 94 and you're like, ah, fuck, I screwed up, but and you have a 50% skill, but you have an obsession that's linked to whatever it is that you're trying to do, you can flip-flop those numbers around, and you can do that all day long with an obsession. Similarly, you have what are called passions. You get 3. There's a rage stimulus, a fear stimulus, and a noble stimulus. So no matter what kind of an asshole you are, you have something noble about your character. And that can also help to flip-flop a role, but you can only use those passions once per session each.
That's really cool.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. And of course, the stress gauges, depending on where you are, but whenever you get triggered by something that forces you to do something, like for instance, if you're going to kill somebody, that's a rank 4 violence check. If you have no ranks in violence, you have to make a check. You have to roll percentile to see if you roll, in the old game, it was your mind stat, to see if you get a hardened notch in violence or if you fail it. If you fail, that's bad. You basically have 3 choices. You can freeze up, run away, or attack whatever it is that's causing your response. If you are hardened to it, however, the next time you get faced with something like that, you don't even have to roll. But that's good and bad because, of course, if you get too many hardened notches, you become desensitized to that thing. And all of a sudden, you become a sociopath. And when you become a sociopath, you can't use your passions anymore.
Oh, I like that. I'm poking around on the Wikipedia page right now, and the madness meters look really fascinating.
Yeah, that's what they were called initially for the first and second editions. They changed it to stress because they wanted to approach the issue of mental health a little bit more delicately, I suppose.
That makes sense. I appreciate that change.
Same.
Wikipedia needs to update.
I also like that they focus on the evil being the humans.
Yeah.
People, especially since you said they're based off Clive Barker, a lot of people don't realize the real villain in Hellraiser is not the monsters. It's the lady. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, it follows very much in that way.
So, Sean, what question you got?
Well, I had a question, and then Eric went and answered it. I was going to ask, because I have this fun history with Eric where he introduces me to games that don't need dice. So every time he comes up with a new game, like, so is this one of your like weird games where you just talk about your feelings? Or do I get to roll dice in this one? But it sounds like it's kind of based on Call of Cthulhu. You have a skill and you roll under that skill, mm-hmm. basically.
Yeah.
Does the GM roll dice? Oh. I didn't mean to interrupt, but
no, I was going to ask, do the GM roll dice, or is this all on the player, onus on the player?
No, the GM rolls dice as well. It's actually a very dangerous system. It's one of the few games that I've come across that being shot once will kill you, period.
Oh, wow.
I want to say it's a little more dangerous than Call of Cthulhu, maybe, because in this one, let's say you have a 70% skill to use firearms and you pick mm-hmm. up a gun whose maximum damage is 50. You roll a 60 out of that 70, you do 50 maximum damage to the person who just got shot. Most people don't have more than 40 or 50 wound points.
Okay. Which
back then used to equate to their body score. So the higher your body stat was, the more wound you can take, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, like if you get shot and you have 50 hit points, and this actually happened to an NPC character from my first campaign, you got shot in the neck, 50 damage exactly. Well, he's dead, just like that. No saving throws, no nothing. You get to zero hit points, you're gone.
Wow.
So, and it's one of the things that they stressed in the rules. It's like, here's six ways that you could stop a fight. When someone pulls out a gun in this game, you do what they tell you to do, or you figure a way out of that situation because you do not want to get shot in here.
So are characters sort of long lasting, or do you churn and burn them? Like how does that happen?
It just depends on what's going on. Depending on what kind of game you're running. Like if it's a very heavy, like firearms and action craziness and explosions and shit. Yeah, I've had many a player character who died in subsequent campaigns that followed my first one. Mainly because they did stupid shit, you know, like, oh, I go to rob a bank. Okay. And I go to do this thing and I go to do that thing. And it's like, okay. And the explosion, yeah, you get caught in the explosion and you get dealt that much damage. Oh shit, I'm dead. Yep, you sure are. One of the things actually in this game, one of the things that's encouraged in this game, and one of the things that I've tried in other games to do to kind of keep the suspense, they encourage you to take your wound points off the sheet, basically behind the curtain. So you mm-hmm. don't know how much damage you just took when the game master's thug guy shot you with a shotgun through the window. You described to them how terrible it sounds like to go through the glass and get the cuts and everything like that, and you're bleeding out. You might have just taken 10 damage, but you don't know that. So that's one of the things that they kind of encourage throughout all the additions. Like, yeah, you want to make sure that your players, play up the fact that violence is real and can get you killed. And yeah, you don't want to resort to it unless you absolutely have to, because yeah, it could mean the end of you.
Hmm.
So you kind of play up the descriptions to kind of hammer that home a little bit.
Could one's magical abilities allow them to rob a bank if they were good at it? Or okay, yeah. So mm-hmm. the person who decided to rob a bank was just not good at robbing banks then.
Oh yeah, in this particular case, the person who made a bank robber was just that. He was a bank robber. Somebody saw Heat back in the day and was like, I'm gonna make that. I'm like,
oh, so okay. They wingrode it and basically okay, that, all right, I know exactly who and what you're talking about. That okay, I get it. Okay, cool. Awesome. Yeah, I can't think of any other questions.
I'm sure Rachel can too, but tackling less, I don't know, carefully handled aspect of the game in previous iterations. Mm-hmm. How have they updated for third edition in a more sensitive era the archetype of the freak, the NPC?
I don't remember seeing one actually. I think to address what you're getting at, there were like archetypes that are no longer in the books. Like there was one in particular that stands. Yeah, some of the stuff got stripped out. I believe. Like there used to be one called the Mystic Hermaphrodite.
Yeah, that's the one that's tied to the freak, right?
Right, and that's no longer, like, I've not seen that anywhere.
So they just scrubbed it out.
The freak is just a very powerful epitomizer, or at least that's one of the possibilities. That's one of the things about Unknown Armies, that it doesn't straight up tell you what something is. It just kind of leaves it up to your imagination.
Or another part of that same question. I'm looking at the schools of magic, and how does it handle pornomancy?
Oh, well.
I'm sorry, what?
So, yes. Before you answer that, because Sean said that, the magic types in this game are modern era. So it's got cleomancy and dipsomancy and entropomancy and like things, mechanomancy, cameramancy.
Like pizzamancy?
Right, exactly. And pornomancy is one of those, because that's a modern part of the zeitgeist. You can't escape it. So it makes sense.
Right.
I'm just curious how they handle it.
I couldn't tell you, because no one in any of my games played a pornomancer. Although that's not to say that they weren't in the game, but they were usually minor characters, or there was like a thing that they had to get. Like one of the things about the reason why the pornomancers exist is because there was once a porn actress that ascended in the middle of a taping, and that precipitated a cult of what they called the Naked Goddess. So when this woman, so when she ascended on camera, everything around her became imbued with this like weird cosmology, you know, power. And everyone sort of, the people who were aware of it created like this sort of cult around her, and they do everything in their power to just be like her, or you know, like get anything they can about her. But the moment she ascended, her name disappeared off of credits. People couldn't find her name in the phone book anymore. Like she just became like this weird aberration in reality. Yeah. So they keep trying to the holy grail for them is the tape. You know, they have to get the tape, this old VHS tape where the, you know, this woman ascended to this celestial clergy, this invisible clergy, as it were.
I will say that for the audience, it's very Clive Barker too, tackling the subject of sex head on and like trying to overcome tropes and stereotypes. That's his thing. I hand it back to Rachel for questions.
Yeah, I am now pawing through the TV tropes page. This game looks really cool and really interesting. So if I wanted to get a feel for the aesthetic and the themes, what movies or TV shows should I watch? What books should I read?
Oh, man. I don't know about the books, because I've never read a lot of, oddly enough, horror fiction or Clive Barker, for that matter, which I absolutely should still. But for me, it was a lot of movies like Lord of Illusions, anything by David Lynch, Lost Highway, Twin Peaks, Mulholland Drive. If you want to nail sort of like the quirky feat, but mixed with the transcendental sense of horror that it pervades a lot of the setting, that's kind of, for whatever reason, that's my go-to. It's always been David Lynch. I don't know why.
I think you'd really enjoy Clive Barker.
Yes.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
If you like what's on the TVs and movies, you'll definitely like the books, because they're so much more visceral. So they're better. You know, it always is.
I'll throw in Cronenberg. Anything with David Cronenberg, perhaps? Yeah.
Everything that you've sort of described makes me think of, I'm pretty sure it's Clive Barker, his Cold Heart Canyon novel.
Yep.
Oh, really?
Really good. Yeah, and it's sort of the same thing where, like, it starts out as like, oh, it's a little bit of a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And then it escalates and there's a character who's dead and he comes back. He's still dead, but he's just walking around. Another character isn't up in hell.
Cool. Yeah, you can kind of do your own thing with Unknown Armies, which is kind of like the appeal, especially with the third edition. with me was it actually has a kind of a personal connection with some of my friends, because it's the one game that I played the most of with them, besides perhaps Delta Green, that I always ran for them. And I was surprised because I actually got to play in one or two games, and it legit shook me. Like, I don't know what it was. I think it was because we decided to do the thing that most people would warn you not to do, which is to play yourself in a role-playing game. And the stuff that went on in that one was just like, and in the world, so to speak, of Unknown Armies, was pretty disturbing. The fact that I was legitimately haunted for like a week or two, just because of the shit that went on in that. And I only played like maybe two sessions. And sadly, my friend who ran me through that passed away, and it was the last game I ran for him before he died. So there's always been kind of like this personal connection with me and this particular game. It's very eerie in some sense, because it's like the last memory I have of them before they pass away. But yeah,
I'm so
it's
sorry for your loss.
Oh, thank you. It's been a long time now, but we really enjoyed that game. That for what I don't know, it was like infectious. I thought I was the only one who would really grasp onto it, and I would thank them for indulging my my weird flavors. My weird tastes in role-playing games. But then it sort of spread, and all of a sudden I had other friends that wanted to run a game of their own too, and I was like, okay, this is great.
So I'm gonna skip over you for a second, Sean, because I have an entrapping question he you kind bad. Of led into. The question is a trap, Eric.
It's
if
a
you
trap.
Could if you could add something to the game, what would it be?
Oh shit. I actually did add some factions to it, but that's not... do you mean like from a mechanical perspective or from like a metaplot perspective? Or
yes, like new metaplot, yes. Like new stuff, new factions, new
yes,
spell archetypes.
I did, actually. I didn't delve too much into archetypes, although I did use them. I didn't add to any of them, though. I thought the ones that were provided were more than enough than I needed. I typically only end up using maybe one or two. I did add a faction, though, that I thought was kind of a neat idea, and I'll be using them in the subsequent game, not initially, but later on. I thought of it would be cool to have like a black magic mafia, like you know, like there are these like central Eastern European mafiosos that show up, and they're really weird to all the other mafiosos. Like they have like this weird sense about them. They're just like, oh, don't talk to those people. Yeah, they're weird. Don't piss them off. All right. They have this mystique about them that it's just like, yeah, don't cross those people, because they will end you. that's the black magic mafia, the magica, I forget what I called them, magica obscura or something like that, some silly name like that.
I love the idea of black magic mafia. That just so many different aesthetics and characters spring immediately to mind.
The audience might get to find out more. That was a trap, because
gasp.
Vorpal Tales does supplements, and Unknown Armies has this thing called the Stratosphere, where you can make your own content at DriveThruRPG.
That'd be
now
pretty
all the writers shit. in this meeting are looking at Eric getting a little drooly.
I legitimately didn't know that. I did not know that. Oh, okay. Oh no, what have I done?
I thought I'd bookmarked all of them. I have one more to add.
Okay. Yeah,
Eric,
so I didn't know that.
You said there was no metaplot or something along those lines?
There was,
okay,
but it's not,
but
the
not
focus. It's not the focus. Yeah, it's not the focus of the game. As a matter of fact, in third edition, they emphasize that the players come up with all the stuff at the table. I'm not going to do that in this particular case, because my entire idea here is to drop my players in cold. They know nothing. And slowly but surely throughout the narrative, they start finding out all this shit. And that's when they get to decide, okay, let's form a cabal. Let's do magic. Okay. Let's unseat this avatar. Hey, fuck that guy. He needs to die. You know, that's something that you're encouraged to, you know, set up at the very beginning of the Unknown Armies third edition. You decide we're going to be this kind of group, and we're going to be doing these kind of things, and we have a goal, and this is what it is. It has a percentage. And as we incrementally move towards that goal, it increases in its percentage. And once we get to 100, we succeed, you know, very straightforward.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So
it encourages that off right from the bat.
Yeah. So your players kind of set their own life goals and try to meet them based on, okay, that's pretty neat. That seems like a very player driven game. Like
it is. Even in the old game, it was very character motivated. It was driven by the characters and their decisions. One of my my cousins played in a very long Unknown Armies game where he played essentially the Punisher, where his family got wiped out by these cultists, and the entire game he spent hunting these people down. But the crowning moment came when he was such a sociopath that he at one point he sat in front of a fireplace, he took out the pictures of his family and he threw them into the fire. Like, he was that desensitized to violence by the time that moment came around that he was like, fuck it, and then none of this shit matters anymore. And maybe it was because he discovered that he enjoyed the killing, or maybe because he could kill, that he continued doing so.
Excellent. Well, we have a lot to digest and absorb. You have a final question for him, Rachel?
Yeah, I want to know what your upcoming game is going to be about. Like, don't, no spoilers or anything, but what's going through your mind? Actually, you know what? I have a better question.
Okay, sure.
What playlist do you have going when you write for Unknown Armies and when you devise your campaigns?
That's a good question.
Funny you should ask. I wrote down a list of different things that inspired me, and one of them was the Lost Highway soundtrack. anything by Johnny Cash, Tom Waits. I have odd tastes, so like, you know, the Silent Hill soundtrack, Yamaoka, some of these older movies, crime drama soundtracks, for some reason do it for me. I don't know. I come up with a lot of interesting things when I start trying to get into that headspace.
Neat.
Perfect.
You know, the questions? There is a whole like little thing that they wrote that kind of encompasses the whole thing. It's literally the thing in the back of the book. In their own words, they write, it's time to stop playing games. The world spins madly on its axis, plunging us headlong towards the end of time. Self-appointed messiahs are crawling out from under every rock. Weird cults are squirming like maggots on a corpse. And magic is flowing from the wounds of the world. If you can throw a punch, steal a car, hack a computer, or cast a spell, you might have what it takes to change the world. Someone's got to. Soon the cosmos will die and be reborn. Next time around, the world might be a terrible place, or it could be paradise. Someone gets to decide. Might as well be you. You could chart the course of reality itself and make a new world in your image. You could be God. Easier said than done. Problem is, lots of people have the same idea. The occult underground rings with the battles of unknown armies, and sides are being drawn. Magical adepts duke it out with the gun-toting enforcers and weirdos of every stripe. Clockwork humans and plotting golems slip through the cracks of society. Entropics eat your memories and spit them back at you with added poison. Fringe groups like the Sect of the Naked Goddess, Mac Attacks, the True Order, and the New Inquisition have all set their sights on the coming apocalypse and put their ante on the table. The only people you can trust are your friends and yourself. You're not always sure about yourself, because when this many people are hungry for power, you better be the one with the fork.
I love it. Stiff. I love it so much.
That seems like a good thing to go out on. We're not going to top that.
Excellent.
John, right. Any final thoughts?
Good night, everybody.
Sweet dreams.
No, when I first heard this, I was like, okay, whatever. And then you sold it, Eric. I'm down. Like, I'm sad. Yes. I don't get to play this one. So, yeah. Aww. I want to be a pizza mancer, just letting you know.
So. My final parting note will be Sunday and Thursday players, don't be surprised if this shows up in the rotation.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
One final note, though, at least until next week when you get to hear another terrifying tale talk, hopefully more with Rachel, because it's awesome having you.
Thank you.
But I have one final thing I have to tell Rachel, though. Hey, Rachel.
But why now? Why now?
Oh, God damn it.
I always said I'd never go walking in dark, scary tunnels again, but eventually... I caved. Good night, everybody. See you next week.